Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody. This is the Joint Committee on Justice and Public Safety Oversight, December 14th, room 643, 1 o'clock.
There it is.
Good afternoon, and members, I appreciate you being here today. We're going to move the agenda on as quickly as possible because I know some of you have other engagements and you will need to be leaving. So our sergeant at arms today, we have Hal Roach. There's Hal. Thank you, Hal. And Linda Matthews. Linda, thank you. And from the House, we have Warren Hawkins. Thank you, Warren. Melisha McCulloch. Thank you. And Jim Moran. Thank you very much. I think at the last meeting, we had added an advisory member, Representative Bob Steinberg. I don't think you were recognized, so welcome. And are there any other members that have been added to the committee? Seeing none, I will also tell the committee that Representative Rena Turner, she could not be with us today. Her aunt passed away, so the committee sends its condolences to Representative Turner. So I will see if either my co-chairs have any comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just welcome everyone, and I wish you all a Merry Christmas.
Representative Bowles.
Thank you. Welcome, and the same. See, Justin got a haircut. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think all of you received earlier the minutes from the last meeting, and I will entertain a motion. So Representative Elmer Floyd moves to adopt those minutes. Do I hear a second? Thank you. Any objection to the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes are adopted. So our first presentation today is Adult Correction Nursing Study, and it's Joe Prater. He's comes to visit us quite often. So if you will hold your questions and remarks until after his presentation, then we will open the floor for comments and questions. So, Mr. Prater.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you again this afternoon. My name is Joe Prater. I'm Deputy Secretary of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice. We appreciate the opportunity to come before you this afternoon to share with you our efforts to enhance our nurse staffing through the reduction of nurse vacancies and the plans we have either had in place or will soon put in place in the near future to attract and retain individuals for this position that remains critical to our healthcare operations. Like all healthcare operations, our nurses represent the backbone of our healthcare operations. Likewise, like all other healthcare operations, private and public, we're facing a challenge in hiring nurses at a time when there is a growing deficit in the availability of nurses. Filling nursing positions is a national dilemma and has been certainly a challenge for us. The time has come for us, DPS, to consider new approaches to staffing our nurses in our correctional facilities. We have begun and are prepared to carry forward new approaches to fill these positions and to keep them filled. Some of these proposals are based on modern-day HR practices, and some, quite frankly, are based on common sense. If what we propose today sounds a bit like private sector approaches, it's because it is. We've got to be real about our competition, and be willing to put ourselves in a better position to compete with the rest of the world in order to reduce these vacancies and to retain our nursing staff. We're pleased that our departmental staff, in working with the Office of State Human Resources, has come up with what we believe are viable alternatives. And I want to thank our correctional health services staff and departments, HR staff, human resources section, in putting this strategic plan together, and I look forward to sharing that with you today. I would like to acknowledge that we have several staff with us here today who are available to answer specific questions you might have, representing both our human resources section and our health services section, and I appreciate their being here with us today. These are the items we've been directed to provide to you regarding nurse vacancies. This information is contained in the report that you previously received and is in this presentation today. What you'll note is that as we go through the slides, those slides are numbered to correspond with the numbers that you see in specific language of the provision. And then at the end, we'll go through, as indicated in that B section, what our plan is to move forward, how we went about reviewing this, and how to move forward with a strategic plan. So we were asked to look at the total number of permanent nursing positions allocated, the number of filled positions, the number of positions that have been vacant for more than 6 months, and an information about where they are located. And we want to provide to you the extent to which temporary contract services are being used for these positions, the method for funding of those positions, and any cost differentials that we have in those between permanent positions and the contracted employees. You've also given us an opportunity to share with you any other information we deem appropriate, and we'll do that as well. In that last section, it does make reference to the fact that a market study, or that to take into consideration market comparisons of salary and retention for nurses, and we have done that. That is part of your report as well. And most of, if not all, this information is based on things that we've discovered in that analysis. Number one, first, this provides a broad snapshot of the nursing positions. So as you can see, let me clarify this as for purposes of this presentation, referencing nursing positions. The provision asked for us to report on nursing positions. I want to identify those so you'll know. Those are as determined to be registered nurses, or RNs, and licensed practical nurses, LPNs. So we're focused on those two positions as quote-unquote nursing positions as part of this study. As Figure 1 indicates, as of November 28, 2017, there were a total of 910 permanent nursing positions allocated to the department, and it shows the number of nursing positions that are filled and those that have been vacant for more than 6 months. So what you'll note is that for those that the vacant positions in the registered nurses will run about 33%. We're looking at LPNs at about 21%. And if you look at the overall vacancy rate, we're looking at about 30% of those, and about 16% of those are running at 6 months or greater. You've identified those as part of this report. We recognize that. We understand that. And we realize that those are the positions that remain for extended periods of time as vacant are those we have to focus on. We intend to do that. In this presentation, we've actually added a chart that shows those by locations specifically. It's not my intention to go through each of those specifically. Would ask that as you review those and you have questions of us about the locations and those vacancies that are at those locations, we'd be glad to do so. These are the vacancies for the registered nurses at locations. The next chart are for the licensed practical nurses by locations. Let's talk a moment about the temporary and contract nurses. Non-full-time permanent nursing positions are currently occupied by either contract or temporary staff. Contract staff, also known as travel nurses, you'll hear those used interchangeably,
are sourced from a total of 18 competitively bid vendors that provide nursing staff on a short-term 13-week contract basis. Temporary staff are sourced from the state's contracted temporary employment agency, Temporary Solutions, who may be employed for 11 consecutive months before they are required by state policy to take a 30-day break. Those are the temporaries. As of October 2017, we were utilizing 62 contract nurses and 28 temp nurses. Of the 62 contract nurses, 50 were RNs and 12 were LPNs. Of the 28 temp solutions nurses, 18 were RNs and 10 were LPNs. These contract and temporary positions are paid on hourly, based on hourly rates, and are funded by the departmental lapsed salaries. In the previous two fiscal years, we've spent between $16 and $17 million each year on contract or travel nurses. Through 5 months of the current fiscal year, we've spent $5.5 million on contract nurses. This chart indicates the cost differences between the average cost of contract nurses and full-time permanent nurses. The full-time permanent staff amounts are inclusive of benefits. I want to make sure you understand that. They don't, however, include this shift differential pay. So doing an analysis of this, when looking at the 62 contracted or travel nurses occupying vacant nursing positions, this means that DPS spends an average of $218,000 more every 13 weeks, or a total of $873,000 per year for contract nurses versus what permanent nursing salaries would average. This increase does not incorporate the temporary staffing. The temporary staffing that's done through Temp Solutions has a different rate, and it's actually included in a budget line item that includes a lot of medical services. We're still working on fleshing that out. These are the contract nurses. This sheds light on the additional cost to the department and the impact on lapsed salaries that occurs when full-time permanent positions would be eliminated and replaced with contracted or temporary positions. With the opportunity to add additional information, we wanted to add this. It's important to note that, as indicated in this slide, contract and temporary nurses may only work on a short-term basis, which inhibits their ability to assume all of the duties and responsibilities of a full-time employee. That is, full-time staff are trained extensively on specific protocols related to patient care. Based on a 13-week contract period, there's not enough time or long-term incentives to train contract and temporary staff on these very same protocols. As a result, the duties assigned to contract and temporary staff employees are typically less involved and are very limited to performing the most basic needs necessary for patient care. So there are, in fact, negative operational impacts of utilizing contract or temporary nurses in addition to the cost differential. As with most jobs, for nurses, in addition to being competitive enough to recruit them successfully, we know we need to, one, focus on keeping them and incentivizing them to stay with us in those critical first years of employment. Two, orient and acclimate them well early on through internships and onboarding efforts. Three, adequately train their supervisors to lead staff with strong, supportive leadership skills and integrity. And fourth, to do what we can to keep the ranks of nurses adequately staffed. Let's look at the current efforts underway, starting with number one, new graduates. As of September 1st, 2017, senior nursing students and recent nursing student graduates are being actively recruited up to 6 months prior to them actually becoming licensed. Pending their successful graduation and RN licensure, they're able to apply, interview, and be contingently offered employment in correctional nursing statewide in our adult correction facilities. In the event that they don't graduate or successfully become licensed as an RN within 6 months of submission of their employment application, their offer is rescinded and they're able to reapply once they are licensed. This program applies to both current North Carolina students as well as out-of-state students interested in relocating to North Carolina. To date, we have received 12 such applications, and 10 of these are in the interview and consideration process, with 3 offers that have already been accepted pending successful licensure. Number 2, staff is working with local community colleges and universities, East Coast Polytechnic Institute and UNC Chapel Hill, to name a couple, to get senior nursing students approved and cleared to perform their 160 hours of educationally required clinical rotations at Central Prison. This would allow us to introduce them to correctional nursing and promote employment opportunities after graduation or licensure, and they would be eligible to apply through the RN statewide continuous posting prior to graduation. Thirdly, we've established 4 healthcare professional regional recruiters. Healthcare professional regional recruiters to allow us to be more aggressive in recruiting nurses statewide. These positions were approved on December 5th, 2017, and we're in the process of posting and screening those. The interviews and selection are anticipated to be completed within the next couple of months. This can be a very powerful tool for us to do substantial recruiting. In addition to the regional nurse recruiters, the department has established a recruiter position that is committed specifically to working with nursing schools to make sure our foot is in the door with these schools to attract these graduating nurses to our jobs. Number 5, the department has increased the practice of using nurse floating, rotating staff pools in all regions of the state, wherever that's feasible, to assist with day-to-day vacancies. This is also designed for and is intended to minimize or mitigate, where possible, job burnout of nurses while offering them a variety of assignments in different specialty areas by rotating their duties to varying facilities located in close proximity to each other, thus strengthening the retention of these nurses. So in many cases, we'll have facilities that are located in close proximity to each other. It makes sense to be able to rotate that staff for the purposes stated here. Number 6, this program has been revised to include specific onboarding efforts, a process through which new employees acquire the necessary knowledge, skills, and behaviors to become effective organizational members. The onboarding process includes formal meetings, lectures, videos, printed materials, computer-based orientations to introduce newcomers to their new jobs and organizations. This includes a structured orientation and preceptorship of nurses, that training that's specifically with an experienced RN, but it also includes the assignment of a buddy who is available to provide a personable approach to blending socially into the organization. As this quote says, and this is from standard text that is in basically HR research and study, research has demonstrated that these socialization techniques lead to positive outcomes for new employees, such as higher job satisfaction, better job performance, greater organizational commitment, and reduction in occupational stress and intent to quit. It must also be emphasized that it is at this point that we must be diligent in preparing our nurses to work within a correctional environment to better assure their personal safety through good safety practices such as enhanced situational awareness. This is critical to us, especially today, of course. Our revisions to our onboarding programs, I assure you, are very heavily focused on that as well. The personal safety of our healthcare staff is paramount to us. In addition to and to complement the new onboarding process for nursing staff, the nurse supervisor orientation has been revised and now includes online classes and seated management leadership classes offered by the Office of State Human Resources, including something called Leading at All Levels. The Leading at All Levels provides integrated, consistent, competency-based, accessible, comprehensive, and cost-effective curricula to North Carolina state government leaders at all levels. Both research and staff exit surveys reveal a simple truth that, as in all lines of work, including nursing, pay doesn't guarantee retention of staff, particularly if solid leadership promoting a healthy, safe, effective, and efficient work environment is lacking. We know that. We have to have solid leadership, and we need to train and orient those leaders to do that. We are committing to enhancing the leadership of our frontline management in order to better support our retention efforts. Now let's look at efforts we propose to put in place to reduce nurse vacancies. I will tell you, while most of these efforts can be achieved using existing resources, some will require some further study and fiscal analyses. We believe their implementation will allow us to substantially reduce our nurse vacancies and therefore decrease the reliance on contract and temp nurses, which, as we've seen, are more costly and have the potential of reducing efficiencies, effectiveness, and safety in our healthcare operations. In the same way I mentioned the need for orientation for nurse supervisors, we believe the establishment of a structured orientation specifically for the position of lead nurse, who are on the front line of nurse supervisors to enhance their supervisory skills, is a key component, very key component, to retaining nurses. Currently, the Health Services Education Committee is in the process of developing a structured orientation for the lead nurse, and that role specifically designed to enhance supervisory skills of lead nurses in their supervision of clinical nursing staff. The orientation will include communication, delegation, problem solving, and organizational skills, and the target for startup of this new orientation is the first quarter of calendar year 2018. Secondly, we need to be competitive in hiring new graduate RNs and propose to do that by, one, hiring them. Effective prior to September 1st, 2017, we required either a 1 or 2 years experience, depending on locations. We are looking at now being able to hire new graduates into these positions. So we want to be able to do that. We want to offer competitive salaries for that you're seeing there. And three, to apply shift differential pay, as we're indicating there, that's available to other nurses at this point, but also to make that available to new graduates. We think that's of value for those as well. I want to go to the second bullet under number two, and make sure you understand. We're looking at this base salary of $50,000 for the new graduate, and you'll see what jumps off the page there is we're looking at $41,308 in the private sector. What I have to emphasize to you is that is simply a base salary in private sector. Typically what you're going to see in the private sector will be substantial bonus pay and sign-on pay that goes in addition to that base pay. What we're talking about is trying to be competitive with those other things by having this salary. So I didn't want you to look at the 50,000 and the 41 and figure that really has to take into consideration other things like bonus and sign-on pay in the private sector. The third proposal recommends utilizing a tiered approach to a salary plan, which is more specifically based on nurses' experience at hiring and which creates incentives for them to stay with us by allowing them to receive structured increases to next tiers as they reach certain years of experience with us. This program is directed toward early to mid-career RNs to assist with recruitment and particularly retention. DPS proposes a tiered salary plan that works in conjunction with the new classification compensation system being developed. Under the new system, nursing salaries will change from career banding to graded. In this slide, an example of how that would work. It can be developed in other ways. We're looking at certain years of spans. You could also use 1 to 3 years or 4 to 6 based on your demands. The plan identifies the nurse's actual years of experience and hires them in a flat salary for the block of experience they qualify in. This works as a retention tool because the nurse is hired at the higher end of the experience scale for that period of experience. As nurses gain years of experience, they progress to the next flat rate for the new qualifying block, which is the retention component. Simply put, this system typically puts nurses at a higher pay at hire, builds in a progression plan, which is predictable and consistently applied, all of which serve as an incentive for them to stay with us. We feel we should be more aggressive in seeking out financial assistance for nurses coming to work for us, such as student loan forgiveness programs, and we're dedicated to seeking that out for the hiring of nurses, particularly in the hard-to-hire locations. These are resources we need to tap into more, and we're committed to doing that. We also recommend the use of sign-on and retention bonus pay. This program would require allocation of funds in order to identify facilities that are extremely short-staffed. The program is currently an approved program pending identification of funds. The program also incorporates an employment agreement which holds the candidate to at least an 18-month commitment. Failure to remain employed in good standing for the 18-month period would require prorated repayment of monies already paid out. Flexible shift schedule. Currently, this plan is only utilized as a weekend option, and that's for Friday through Sunday staffing. Under this plan, the employee works 3 12-hour shifts and is paid 40 hours. Something we already have in place. It's a fairly common practice for this kind of shift scheduling. These employees also receive part-time benefits with full-time pay. And we believe there's nothing that prohibits the extension of this flexible shift option to other days where there may be demands there. This plan could be utilized to allow staff to work 3 12-hour shifts in blocks that cover other periods throughout the week. This also gives a 4-hour window in which staff can work without receiving overtime pay premiums if needed. An implementation of this program would require an annually renewable employment agreement, which allows for no more than these scheduled blocks off per year, which are paid using vacation or sick leave. Our proposal is also to create a policy and plan in conjunction with the Office of State Human Resources to reward current employees who refer qualified candidates for established hard-to-recruit positions at such as registered nurses. There would be a payout to the referring employee with the first active pay period that the candidate is employed, and there'd be a supplemental payout once the referred employee reaches a predetermined employment milestone. All payouts are subject to qualifying guidelines, which would ensure that both the referring and the referred are in good employment standing at the time of payout. Budgeting would be needed for this process, and we look forward to exploring that as a possibility. Many nurses in both the public and private sectors are interested in striking a better balance between their work and home life. For this reason, there is a higher demand for part-time positions. This hiring practice can be used to provide additional staffing based on staffing demands and locations. This hiring practice can be used to provide additional staffing. Half-time and per diem staffing are currently supplied through temporary solutions. By splitting two full-time positions, staffing could be increased by up to 496 hours per year, or 41 12-hour shifts annually. Funding for these additional hours would be necessary, but would be recovered to the savings realized through the forfeiture of benefits, since those working half-time receive benefits on a prorated schedule, while those working on a per diem basis receive no benefits as long as they're under 30 hours per week. Now, what this shows in this slide are the standard current staffing models, and we've looked at a couple of proposals where we split some of these full-time equivalencies into part-time, half-time positions. So this is a phenomenon that's occurring now that we need to look at as a possibility, where there are those who are looking at balancing home life with work life, and we can offer these to fill the gaps where needed at appropriate locations. We thought we'd also include some information about the difficulties in keeping nursing positions filled nationally, as there is a shortage of nurses due to the fact that the increase in the aging and chronically ill population, combined with many nurses now reaching retirement age, are creating essentially a perfect storm, driving demand for nurses. This again underscores our need to be more aggressive in our recruitment and retention of nurses as we compete with this increasing demand. I saw something recently that a report indicated that with the huge demand of nursing needs in this country, over half of that growing demand comes from 10 states. Half of the national growing demand comes from 10 states. North Carolina is one of those 10 states. We think the current and proposed programs for the recruitment and retention of nurses discussed with you today can reduce the overall vacancy rates of our nurses, and we look forward to a strong continuing collaboration between our health services staff, DPS, human resources staff, and the Office of State Human Resources to get there. We've got a lot to do. We're committed to this, and we look forward to the positive results we believe they'll produce and being able to report that to you in the future. I appreciate your attention. We'll be glad to answer questions you might have. Madam Chair.
Representative Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Prater, for being with us today and presenting this information. I have a series of questions, Madam Chair, if I could.
You're recognized for a series of questions.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Ms. Prater, I've had a chance to serve on this committee for 7 years. And when I was here the first year, I heard the same things we're hearing today, that we have a shortage of nurses. And I commend you for bringing recommendations to the committee to address that shortfall. But I do have specific questions. Why do you have, in your opinion, all these vacancies? I mean, I understand what you've just said. Is it anything specifically to the population they're serving, or anything you can put your hand on and your experience in these situations?
Thank you, Representative Graham. It's generally recognized that the desire to be able to hire is somewhat inhibited by the fact that a lot of these might be in remote locations. That's what makes some of these things that we're promoting that would go straight to that. I think that is a contributing factor. So besides the kind of this umbrella of the fact that there's generally this difficulty in hiring, remote locations, rural locations are particular challenges, and it is a correctional environment. And so we have to be able to address that and be very solid on how we prepare folks for that, recruit for that, and be successful in it. I think the fact that we happen to be in a state that's growing as well, and that demand is growing, so our competition has grown substantially. So I think it's these things we're talking about, plus some of the uniqueness of where the facilities might be located.
Well, I can certainly relate to the rule,
yes, sir,
and to the to that aspect of what you're talking about. A further question is: you talked about you have 20 some vacancies in the LPN and X number in the RN. Is there any? Have you given any consideration to incentivizing LPNs who are in the system working, probably worked a long time? But any incentives to those individuals from the state to pursue an RN degree? I mean, if they're in healthcare and they're an LPN, it might be a financial obligation that right. They're not able to meet. Yeah. And if we realize that we have this urgency, are we doing anything to incentivize those LPNs to go ahead and somehow or another, with the state's help, financially, to get their RN degree? I mean, the community colleges are within their communities, is within reach. That's another question I'm asking for you to consider and for us to consider. I think it's something that we need to do and look at those individuals who are in the system getting their RN certification.
Representative Graham, I think that's an excellent point, and I'd be happy to go back as to whether we're doing that. I would ask our folks if we've got that, but let me say to you that we'll definitely go back and take a look at that and add that to our list of things to where we can create a career progression for the LPNs to an RN and provide some incentive to do that.
Let me ask another question, Madam Chair. Do you use certified nursing assistants in your environments?
Representative Graham, yes, we do.
And if you use those in your environment, incentivize those individuals to stay within your system, get their LPN, and move into the RN category. I mean, it's just,
yes, sir.
I'm just thinking from an educational model.
I appreciate that.
We've got people in the environment, we've got them, and they're working. I think we should incentivize them in those ways to pursue their degree and stay in the system. The average stay for your nurses, what is that?
Thank you, Representative Graham. Madam Chair, I would yield to our folks on staff, if I might, for that answer. The average stay of a nurse with us.
Who do you want to call to the mic?
Is this a contract nurse or stay?
Representative Graham, I take that you're talking about the full-time staff.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. Do we have that information? Representative Graham, if... I appreciate that. That's something we will get for you, and we can provide that to you, certainly.
We'll have staff get that for you.
And that'll be fine. One more follow-up, Madam Chair. Do you do exit interviews?
We do. Yes, sir. This is very valuable information we receive from the exit interviews, and these are the kinds of things that we need to come up with. And as I had indicated, you know, these exit interviews will tell you, as I said previously, it's not all about pay.
Right.
It's about the work environment. It's about the leadership. And so that's a large focus of this as well.
I just want to say thank you for being here today. And I think it's our responsibility to take your recommendations, look at those recommendations. We understand what you're up against. I do. I'm a business person.
Yes,
I have to have people to work. If I don't have people to work, then we're going to have problems. So right. you're bringing a genuine problem to us, and I think it's our responsibility to look at your considerations, your recommendations, and see to assist you and assist the system with this, because health care is important to our inmates as well, and getting qualified and certified staff to implement and to do that scope of practice is very important. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Representative Graham.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for your presentation today. I just wondered, and maybe I missed it, but are you using or thinking about the community colleges, how much they can help with this maybe?
Representative Hurley, I'm getting nods in the back. I'm still learning the process, but I'm looking at folks in the back who are indicating that we are using the community colleges. We'd be happy to provide you with some more detail about that if you'd like. Thank you.
Representative McNeil.
Thank you, Mr. Prater, and for the good work that y'all are doing in studying this very critical issue. Madam Chair, I do have just a couple of questions, but I'll try and keep them brief. Thank you. Mr. Prater, it seems like all of the solutions that you have brought to us are the state of North Carolina continuing to be the employer for nurses. I'd like to a question. You probably don't have this information, but I'd like for you to get it to me. When the state of North Carolina hires these nurses and there is a malpractice or there is a lawsuit or an inmate claim, how much is the state of North Carolina paying out a year to defend or paying for these claims that these nurses or whatever are not giving proper medical care? Do you have any figures on that?
Representative McNeil, I do not. We'll be glad to get that information for you and provide that to you.
Okay, and then going off of that thought, most of the sheriffs across the state contract their medical care out in their jails, and when they do that, those companies they contract with take care of the liability issues if there's a malpractice suit. They defend those, and they also pay the claims. So my question is I know it probably wouldn't work at every prison, but have you thought about maybe taking a prison here or a prison there and maybe contracting out for private sector medical care for those prisons? And like I said, I know it may not work on a statewide basis, but have you tried it in the past at any of the prisons, and do you think that probably might be something that you could try at selected locations?
Representative McNeil, I appreciate that. We can certainly take a look at that. It's not uncommon to carve out certain locations or operations where that might be in our best interest to do that. To date, we have not done a full-blown analysis of that at this point.
Thank you. Well, it's something I would like for you to look into, and I'll thread everybody else on the committee agrees with me, but liability is a big part of this picture that we haven't talked about, because when these are employees of the state, And there's a malpractice, it's the state that's going to have to pay the defendant. The state's going to have to pay the claim if there's a claim. So if we could reduce some of that liability, it might be a good thing.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sir, on page 18 of your presentation under flexible shift schedule, you listed one of those as being time off guidelines to ensure dedicated staffing, and I'm wondering if you can explain to me what that is.
Thank you, Representative Jackson. I'm going to ask our human resources staff that would dig into that a little bit and provide some details of that, Madam Chair.
So who is coming to the mic from the back?
We're going to ask Sarah Royster to speak to the group. She is a personnel analyst who works with what we call our critical areas, such as this, and is one of the individuals who works very closely at some of these alternative approaches, and she comes with experience in other healthcare operations.
Good afternoon. I am Sarah Royster, and I'm the critical needs analyst for DPS. Could you repeat the question one more time, please?
Yes, ma'am, Ms. Royster. On page 18, there was some talk about flexible shift schedule, and one of the bullet points was time off guidelines to ensure dedicated staffing. And particularly what I'm asking or what I'm looking for is,
Oh, go back.
Is this basically like you have a nurse who works weekends at the prison, and she wants to take a weekend off? Is she responsible for finding her replacement? Is that why? Is that what a guideline to ensure staffing is?
No, sir, not exactly. Normally, under the flexible weekend plan as it stands now, the employee commits to 48 out of 52 weekends a year, or so many weekends off per quarter or every 6 months. With that employment agreement, they are recognizing that if they must be off, whether it's pre-approved for vacation, holiday, family time, or if it is a call out because of a sick child or sickness, that they are limited to the 4 weekends per year that they may utilize sick time or vacation time. Once they exceed that limit, they have now gone beyond the guidelines for this program, and they would not be eligible to re-enroll to renew that employment commitment at a later date. What that does is that allows us to count on having that nurse for 48 out of 52 weekends in 1 year increments at a time. Now, as long as the program is available, they're eligible to renew that 1 year employment commitment and continue on with that schedule, which allows them to build their life around a predetermined work schedule. Did that answer your question, sir?
Yes, ma'am, that did. So if I could, just one follow up would be, yes, so if, you know, if someone knows they want a Saturday and Sunday in June off now, they're given, they can pick those 4 weekends they want off, subject to proper notice and things of that.
That is correct. Yes, sir. There would be a guideline of how much notice they would need to give for it to be a pre-approved event.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Senator Bryant.
I had, I think, two questions, Madam Chair, and perhaps a follow-up.
You're recognized.
Thank you. I was very interested in your option for the student loan forgiveness. There wasn't a lot of information there except that you're using, it sounds like you're using a HRSA grant or something. For that, I was just curious, is that in place or is it something to come online? How successful is it? It would seem like that would be attractive for the graduate nurses.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Senator Bryant. This is to indicate that we want to begin exploring that. We are not currently consistently pursuing that. This is a commitment saying that we will dig in. We'll see what's available. We'll see where that's applicable. There are certain federal guidelines that go with that, certain criteria that must be met when you apply those, whether it's a grant or whether it's a loan forgiveness program. We're saying that we're not doing it as much as we'd like to. We're not doing it adequately. So we're going to move forward in looking at all the possibilities. I hope that we before you at a later time and tell you what we're doing.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
I was just curious as to, you know, what's your timeline for that? And you mentioned in that slide there were some facility requirements. Do you know whether you even meet? Whether you have facilities that meet the federal requirements, or is that all have to be explored?
Thank you, Senator Bryant. That is part of the exploration, is to figure out where that would be eligible and how we can pursue that.
Okay. One more question or comment. Yes, I would encourage that because I think that would be an attractive feature. Mm-hmm. For the goal that you have, particularly with new graduates.
Yes, ma'am.
And second question is, I noticed you said do you have a current 8-hour shift model for nurses, or is your current model 12, or does it vary, you know, what kind of hour per day model are the nurses working on?
There's currently an 8-hour shift and a 12-hour shift. Yes, ma'am.
Follow up. And do they have that choice, or does it depend on where they are?
It's based on the facility.
Okay,
and then the need of that facility.
Right. And do we have? You may have shared this before. Seems like I remember, but I could be off.
Yes,
do we have good information on what is attractive for the nurses in terms of working for? In the corrections facilities, and what the downside is? Do we know what the major pros and cons are that we're trying to either take advantage of or avoid?
Thank you, Senator Bryant. I think we intuitively know some of these things. We've learned from exit interviews, things about leadership, what are you doing to make the environment safe for me, are really kind of at the top of the list. We want to continue to review that and focus more on that. So it's really primarily what we're learning through these exit surveys that are starting to rise to the top. Those are the types of things we need to try to improve at.
Representative Steinberg.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, and Mr. Deputy Secretary, thank you for your presentation. Pardon me. Madam Chairman, I've got a couple of questions. I'm going to just kind of roll if it's okay. Okay, thank you. You had mentioned, Mr. Prater, about an underlying problem, and the one of the underlying problems you mentioned could be supervision and leadership skills, or a lack of that. And that could be contributing to this attrition that you're experiencing within the ranks of nursing. In fact, the attrition that you're experiencing throughout the entire system. And my question, as it relates to nursing, one of my questions is, how long has this particular shortage occurred? Can you give us some historical perspective going back maybe 6 or 7 years, and has it been consistently, are these numbers similar to what we saw 6 or 7 years ago?
Representative Steinberg, the information I've received thus far would indicate in the last few years we've gone somewhere between 20 to 30% of a vacancy rate. So the answer, the short answer to that is that for an extended period of time we have essentially been at that level of vacancies in nurses.
You mentioned 2 to 3 years, is that correct? That there was a change in leadership over at the Department of Corrections about 3 years ago, and I'm just trying to see if perhaps maybe some of the implementations have not contributed in a more significant way to the numbers that you're presenting to us today. The considering wages, and the wages seem to be pretty competitive from what I can tell, it makes one wonder in areas of high unemployment why there are not more applicants for these jobs. Now, skills certainly could be, and qualifications could be a factor. But I'd like to just step back for a moment and have you think about this. Has there been any uptick in the vacancy numbers since the 5 murders in northeastern North Carolina that began in April in the system? Have you are you experiencing more challenges as a result of that?
Thank you, Representative Steinberg. I would need to yield to our staff to see if we have any data on that, and whether that has had an uptick. Madam Chair, if I could call on someone from staff, please.
So who are you calling upon?
I'm going to call on Ms. Anita Myers, who is our Director of Nursing.
Anita, if you'll come to the mic in the rear of the room, please.
I'm Anita Myers. I'm the Director of Nursing for Health Services. And to answer the question about if we've seen any impact on what recently happened at a couple of the facilities, the two facilities where the assaults occurred, we have we do see a dramatic impact to being able to recruit nurses to those two facilities, especially the Pasquotank and Bertie. Those are the two facilities. We had several nurses to leave because of that, and we still have several nurses that are off on leave due to those incidents that have not returned to work. So we haven't even been able to recruit some travel nurses to those two facilities, and they do cite that it was the information publicized in the paper and out of concern for their safety, that they're not willing to either come back as a travel nurse or consider working there as a travel nurse. So we hope with time, as we put more safety measures in place, we were able to address that, and we've been able to continue provide the care that we have because of dedicated nurses that's been pulled to those areas to work during these times of severe shortages at those two facilities. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that begs the bigger question. I expect most of us surmise that that was probably the case in at least in these two facilities, and perhaps more broadly across the system.
Now, Representative Steinberg, we are here today to talk about the nursing shortage.
Correct.
So if you will,
and we are doing
concentrate
that,
your questions to
these,
that.
These are all related to the nursing shortage. So if you'll just bear with me, Madam Chairperson, I'd appreciate it. The you're mentioning about the safety of these nurses as being an issue, and they're very concerned about their safety. And we know that those folks who are there to provide safety for them, correction officers, I'm presuming, for the most part, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. Correct. Well, we're talking about safety for nurses. We have a tremendous shortage of correction officers as well. So that may be an issue for another day, but it's part of the bigger question, I think, that you know, this is good, all of these steps that you're taking or proposing, but I don't think that this in and of itself is going to get to the root of the problem, that there's a bigger problem that has to be resolved. Now, you mentioned during the exit interviews, you mentioned that work environment and leadership, again, are concerns that those coming out of the system, these nurses coming out of the system, they're concerned about that. They're causing concern among these people. They either don't feel as though they're getting good direction from leadership, and the work environment and the safety hazards as a result have got to be part of that, and they in fact have said that. So I think this is more of a comment than a question, and I'll conclude with this. I believe that after hearing your presentation, and I believe this even before your presentation, that the underlying problems, this particular problem we have with the shortage of nurses, is part of a bigger problem that we have with the current leadership within the Department of Corrections. And I'll close with that. Thank you.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions, if I might. Mr. Prater, it seems in my discussions with people in the medical field that there are more and more males getting into nursing. Are you seeing any increase in the ratio of male to female nurses wanting to come into correctional nursing?
Representative Faircloth, I'm being told that is not the case with our employment, that we're not seeing an increase in that.
That's the same question. Along that same line, the military, we're a military state. We've got a lot of good folks in the military in our state. And at any given time, some of them are cycling out. And some of those that are cycling out, are a good number of them, are medically trained. Now, they may not have been trained as a civilian nurse is trained, but they've been trained pretty doggone good, particularly in trauma and so forth.
Sir.
What do you see as sources coming out of the military that we can keep in North Carolina and get into the correctional system?
Representative Faircloth, I think this will be a great benefit of these regional recruiters that we're talking about. We need to connect with the military as well, and because I think that you're right, that's a source of those coming out that we could have some recruitment efforts with to see if they would continue their medical careers with us. So we certainly do need to tap into the military resource.
Follow up. I want to, you know, we've had a chance through our committees over the past 6 or 7 years to take a long, hard look at the correctional system. And if you look back 3 or 4 years, you'll find that there's an awful lot written nationally about the steps forward we have made in our correctional system. And I think it would be improper for us to label that correctional system as having an incurable cancer. I think we owe it to those of you who are in that profession to walk beside you and help you get to where the answers are. And I think we also need to recognize the progress that we have made over the years. Is it perfect? No. But there is absolutely no harder employment in this state than working in a correctional system. And yes. I thank you for what you do.
Thank you, Representative Faircloth. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Prater, what struck me, both from some comments like from Representative McNeil and from your presentation, we might need to look at a bigger context of the structure that you're dealing with. What I'm seeing in your presentation talks about flexibility and moving people around. We have a good compensation system in state government when you look at the total package, but to maximize that compensation, you have to stay here 30 years. And that works in a lot of professions, and that's worked in prior generations. However, we're now facing the biggest generation that's come along, the millennials, and they are different. They don't want to buy a house. They'd rather rent. They don't want to buy a nice car. They'd rather Uber. They will not make a commitment. They don't want to make 30 days. They don't want to make a 30-minute commitment. So you're trying to fit them into a slot that's worked for years, and now it's not working so well. And I'm wondering if we could look at, like some of our more elite state employees have done, like college professors, if we would consider a system where you were going to millennials and saying, here's some cash and here's a portable retirement system. You might find it interesting to work in a correctional system for 3 years, but you might not want to make a 30-year commitment full time. I'm going to stay at this. I think that might address, there's a generational wave that we're facing that private sector is struggling to deal with and the public sector is struggling to deal with. Nursing is one of those things, it doesn't matter where you work, public, private, nonprofit, state, I mean, none of that matters. A nurse can pop around and get a job anywhere, anytime, any place. And we're not giving them that flexibility. The way we structured our compensation is fine if you're willing to make a 30-year commitment. But for millennials, it's not going to work.
Thank you, Senator Wells. I think that's very relevant, the generational thing. This is kind of a step toward moving off the conventional that we've been doing with some other options. But you're right. There's some other things we need to look at. Think outside the box a little bit in the compensation to be competitive. Absolutely.
Senator Bryant, did you want to ask another question?
I was wanting to follow up on the issue of safety and just to ask the question, how do we currently address that? Is it the case that a corrections officer is always with a nurse when they're with an inmate? Or, you know, sort of what is the standard process for that?
Thank you, Senator Bryant. Our health services staff work very closely with custody to make sure that in all situations they have the correct security. And I can tell you operationally that that's happening. What What we think needs to be done is an individual kind of situational awareness that goes with a professional who's a non-certified person within that facility. We're now looking at developing a program for non-certified staff. In addition to the safety and security that comes along with a correctional officer, there needs to be some personal understanding, and we want to train them at that. We're in the process of developing that in addition to the custody staff with them.
So follow up. So it is the case that it's as a general rule, the custody staff, there's custody staff always with the medical staff and the inmate patient?
I will yield to our health services staff, Madam Chair, if I might, because that's into the operations. One thing that does strike me, Senator Bryant, is there are, I'm just going to say, some HIPAA requirements and certain things that go along with this, with managing a patient. So while the operation would be that we make sure we have that on a case-by-case basis within this room or that room, I'm going to let Ms. Catlett address that.
I was just asking how it does work and what rules are.
Yes,
Ms. Catlett. Good afternoon. My name is Terry Catlett. I currently serve as the Deputy Director of Health Services. I'd like to just kind of give you an overview of the day-to-day operation. So in every one of our facilities, some of you have been to visit. Thank you. We have a small health services unit where we have several exam rooms and pharmacy, etc. In all of our facilities, a correctional officer is assigned to that area, and he or she will supervise the inmates that come to and fro for appointments, examinations, etc. In addition, any time one of our nurses has to go into one of our restricted housing units where inmates are in single cell status, an officer will escort the nurse door to door as we're passing out medication or providing education or whatever the case may be. So when we're in the confined areas, we have an escort, but when we are in our health services unit where there are many staff mingling, there is usually one officer assigned to that particular area that, again, oversees the inmate coming in and out and providing any kind of resource that we might need. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
One follow-up.
Is your sense that that level of security with custody staff is adequate, both to provide the security that's needed and to meet the concerns of the staff you're recruiting?
Madam Chair, I would appreciate yielding to Ms. Catlett again on that, as she has the knowledge of the operations in depth and her sense of that, Senator Bryant.
In our outpatient facilities, again, where it's a much smaller operation, I think that having the officer there present at all times is adequate. Certainly in our inpatient facilities here, in our North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women and at our Central Prison Healthcare Complex, there's a much higher ratio of officers to nurses in those settings because it's an inpatient setting and it requires additional services, especially in our mental health unit, where many times you will have at least two officers to escort one inmate patient to an exam room where the provider will evaluate them. So there is always at least a minimum of two officers escorting one patient to an exam room where we have our providers.
And then one more follow-up, Madam Chair. I know that we're belaboring.
Yes, ma'am, but we have another person who wants to ask the question.
And is there an exception to the HIPAA requirements, patient confidentiality that applies in custodial settings, or could you give us a sense of what we face there?
Well, certainly it's a based on those who just need to know. So broadly, all officers know that they are to follow all the Center for Disease Control, use universal precautions at all times, and if at any time there needs to be a situation where an officer might be privy to some information, then certainly those rules do apply. But that information, again, is on a need-to-know basis for transport or whatever the case might be.
Representative Floyd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your report, and I look at the locations of the facilities, and some of them, you know, I've been in North Carolina all my life, and most of them, a lot of them, I don't even know where they are.
Yes, sir.
So that's no indication that about the location. But my concern is that I see on page 17 where you have one pay period. Given the location of these facilities, have you looked at something new as it relates to retention or bringing in individuals to these unique places? Unique locations.
Representative Floyd, I assume you're talking about maybe the particularly hard to hire locations that have that unique challenge.
Some of the Madam Chair. Some of the locations are unique. They located in so unique places.
Yes, sir.
And we have just one pay period. Is it in, you know, some of these places are so far from urban area that more incentive may need to be looked at to attract individuals to some of these unique locations.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that. We have got to focus on those locations with other kinds of approaches. These are locations where we might want to apply a sign-on bonus or certain other pay that we could get approved, the Office of State Human Resources, to create more of an incentive at these difficult locations, these unique locations. There may be other ways we can look at that, but it's not cookie cutter. We know that we've got to base our recruitment efforts based on locations and not just kind of a left to right across the state standard. There are some things we need to do at those locations additionally.
Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Perhaps we need to look at county population that may be used as a measuring stick, because when you look at Charlotte, you have 1 million population, but there's no facilities.
Right.
You know, within striking distance, you know, of Charlotte, which is the metropolitan area. For instance, Fayetteville, you know, is the largest city going east, southeast, next to Wilmington. You know, it's just something that perhaps, Madam Chair, that the committee, you know, can look at as it look at recruitment, you know, of the various nurses to staff these facilities.
Yes, sir. We can certainly do what the committee would like for us to look at for those locations.
So, are the questions from the committee? If not, the chair has a couple of questions. I understand from your presentation that the department does have practices in place to attract employees and to retain employees. So when I go back and pull the data from July 2016, at that time you had 213 vacancies. 173 of those, the average days of vacancy was 173 days, or roughly 5.5 months. So then in January 2017, you had a vacancy number of 244. Of those, the average days of vacancy was 187 days, which was a little over 6 months. And then today, when we look at the report, you show a vacancy today of 266, which is more than either of the other totals. But then as of those today, you show out of the 202 that they were only vacant 118 days, and of the 65 licensed practical nurses, they were only vacant 26 days. So that tells me that, you know, something maybe you've implemented something that perhaps is working. Do you know what your percentage of turnover is in the nursing positions?
I would... We've had some discussion about this, Madam Chair, and we'll be glad to provide that to you. I realize that is a critical thing that you need to know, is the turnover rate.
If you could do that, and also at the same time, I want to know the amount of the lapsed salary that was generated by these ongoing nurse vacancies.
Yes, ma'am. Be glad to do that.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Prater, for coming today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I think next on our agenda is Private Protective Services, and I have Brian Jones, who is the Executive Director. And Mr. Jones, I understand that you're going to do both presentations for Private Protective Services and the alarm systems licensing. We would like to break for questions in between the two presentations.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Brian Jones, the Director of Private Protective Services. I've been in this role just shy of 4 months. So since I'm new, I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. Prior to coming to Private Protective Services, I was a Director of Planning and Development with the Durham County Sheriff's Office. Before that, I was a prosecutor in Durham. I got my start in public safety as a correctional officer in Florida at a maximum security state prison, and later served as a police officer and a detective at the Pensacola, Florida Police Department for about 7 years before I went to law school. So I'm happy to be at Private Protective Services, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to provide the committee an overview of the work that the boards are doing at Private Protective Services. There are two licensing boards under Private Protective Services: the Private Protective Services Board, or PPSB, and the Alarm Systems Licensing Board, or ASLB. The bulk of the work that that Private Protective Services conducts is related to private protective services, so I'll begin there. The board operates pursuant to the Private Protective Services Act, which is General Statute 74C. There are 14 board members, and the breakdown is on that slide. The board meets 6 times a year, every other month. So we have a board meeting every month, PPSB 1 month, and then followed by the Alarm Systems Licensing Board the next month. All the meetings are 2 days. We have the first day, which is committee meetings, grievance, and screening. Then I'll get into that in a little more detail. And then the next day is the full board meeting. One of the primary functions of each board is to evaluate the credentials of people applying for licensure with the board. So the board grants licenses. The best way to understand this, there's a couple definitions that I need you to be familiar with. One is licenses. This is the individual that applies to represent the business entity. So whether it's a corporation or a sole proprietorship, the licensee holds the license for the business. And then registrants are the actual employees of that company or the license holder. So the best way to think about this is for Private Protective Services, an example, a security guard company would be the license holder, or someone affiliated to represent that company. And then the registrants would be the individual security guards that work for that license holder. So the board in their committee meetings hears the findings of investigations where people are seeking licensure. So when a person applies to hold a license, our field services supervisor assigns an investigator to conduct a background investigation. The investigator gathers information about the person's character, references, employment history, all related to whether they're fit to hold that license in North Carolina that they're seeking. The board considers those in the committee setting and then makes a recommendation as to whether to grant or deny the license to the full board, and the board acts on those. The board also, a primary function is to investigate complaints against license holders, whether it's a license violation or registration violations. A lot of times those come in the form of unlicensed activity on a part of people in North Carolina who are perhaps conducting business without a license through Private Protective Services. They may be installing alarms without being licensed first, or for registration violations. So if a company is employing members that are not properly registered through the board, a lot of times the board hears those complaints as well. And Private Protective Services is responsible for licensing those eight categories that are listed: private investigators, security guards, both armed and unarmed, the armored car profession, courier service, guard dog service profession, electronic countermeasures profession, polygraph examiners. Of course, this is just civilian polygraph examiners, not law enforcement polygraph examiners, and then psychological stress examiners. Support for both boards is conducted by a single staff of 22 employees. So the breakdown is that we have eight positions that are responsible for registrations, that receive the applications for registration and vet those, examine criminal history, and make decisions on whether someone should be registered. And then eight field services positions. These are investigators. We have a field services supervisor that oversees the investigative function, and then we have several investigators strategically located throughout the state. There are two investigators in Raleigh. We have another individual who serves as a training coordinator and an investigator, and then we have several who are spread throughout the state. As far west as Hickory, we have someone in Greensboro. We have an investigator in Charlotte and an investigator in Fayetteville, so we try to cover the state. So the investigators will receive an assignment to conduct investigations for a license holder. They'll go out in that area. We try to assign, obviously, geographically to make the best use of resources. And then those investigators will vet the candidates for a licensure before they're presented to the board. We have three licensing positions that are solely responsible for these, for coordinating the license application process. A lot of volume. One thing I did in preparation for this presentation was try to determine how many calls that the agency receives on an annual basis. And the call volume, 48,000 annually, represents incoming calls to the main number at Private Protective Services and all outgoing calls. So it's really a conservative estimate of the number of calls that we're receiving regarding licensing and registration. The reason being is when we send correspondence out from the agency, we list the specific registration employee who's responsible for that application. And we put their contact name and information so people will have a personal contact. If they have questions about their application, they can reach out. So a lot of those calls are coming to our individual employees if they have calls about their application. We're a division of the Department of Public Safety. We were transferred from the Department of Justice pursuant to a law back in 2014. We receive support from the Department of Public Safety that includes all of our human resource functions, fiscal management responsibility, all information technology support, legislative services, and motor vehicles are issued by the Department of Public Safety. There's a statutory mandate in 74, Chapter 74, that requires the Private Protective Services to pay for the support from the Department of Public Safety. That existed before when Private Protective Services was under the Department of Justice, and we continue to pay for some of those for those services under DPS pursuant to the state statute. And I'll get into a little bit of the data that I have for Private Protective Services Board, and then later move to the Alarm Systems Licensing Board. For Private Protective Services, this graph represents a breakdown of licensees and registrants. And if you recall, licensees, again, is the business entity, can be a sole proprietor or a corporation, and then registrations are the individual employees working for those entities. So we saw a slight decrease in 2017 of registrations and a slight increase for licensees in 2017. And a breakdown of those categories of licensees. This is current licensees. About 72% of licensees are private investigators. Followed by the security guard profession, which is 16%. And then the third highest category of license holders is this electronic countermeasures, which the statute describes as people who are capable of identifying surreptitious listening devices, or more commonly referred to as bugs. And then 9% is really all other categories. So, for instance, We have, I believe, in North Carolina, there are 4 guard dog service license holders. There are about 20 polygraph examiners and about 11 psychological stress examiners. So those other categories constitute the 9% of remaining license holders. And then under registrants, the breakdown is a little different, obviously, because the security guard companies have multiple employees a lot of times, both armed and unarmed guards. So about 84% of our registrants, or approximately 15,000 in the state of North Carolina, are registered unarmed guards. And then armed guards constitute about 2,300 or 13% of registrants. And then the next highest category is armored car profession, which constitutes about 3% of the registrants, or about 450 armored car registrants throughout the state. As I mentioned previously, one of the main functions of the board is to hear formal complaints, or what the board refers to as grievances. And I've demonstrated the number of formal grievances that the board has heard during each of their 6 meetings annually for the last few years. The highest was in 2013 in recent history at 50, and then dropped in 2015, and we're at 30 for this year, which includes hearings or grievances that the board will hear at their public meeting next week in Raleigh. Moving on to finances, for the last 2 fiscal years, there's been a lot of changes within private protective services. The revenues have decreased slightly and expenditures have increased. That's largely attributed to 2 main causes. One is that private protective services moved prior to my duties as director from one location to another. There are several expenses related to the move, and so that was one of the reasons that we saw an increase in expenditures. The other reason is related to a computer project that we're currently implementing. One thing that we're trying to do is eliminate paper waste. Up until recently, we continued to receive paper applications for registration and licensures. We're transitioning away from that system in the process of doing that. And so we have, as you can imagine, we've received paper applications historically. We have a lot of paper in the office that we're trying to scan electronically. So we've partnered with a company, and I'll get into a little more detail about this later, with Permidium, and we're archiving all of that paper documents and storing that electronically. And of course, that comes at a cost. And so that's one of the reasons that we've had an increase in expenditures to try to archive those documents. There are several revenue sources from Private Protective Services Board. Of course, the bulk of revenue comes from licensing and registration. About 73% last year for fiscal year 17 came from the cost of registration and licenses. And then, of course, interest-bearing accounts yield some revenue. Administrative fees. One thing that the board does when they hear a grievance, a lot of these cases, as I mentioned, are related to a lack of registration compliance. So over the course of an audit period, the investigators may uncover that several employees were not registered properly. What the board does is through a formula, they calculate the number of employees that were unregistered, assign a figure to that, what they would have paid had they been properly registered, and then assesses an administrative fee that tries to recover some of the costs that the investigators are bearing as a result of their investigation, and sometimes the extensive audits that they're conducting to try to determine who was properly registered and who was not. And so that is part of the revenue that's generated for PPSB. We also have firearms permit fees, instructor certifications, and training materials, and late fees for registrations or licenses that are submitted beyond the expiration date. We accept late fees for some of those applications. A little breakdown in the expenditures for the Private Protective Services Board over the last 2 fiscal years. You can see that we've had an increase in personnel services or salaries. The increase in purchase services, like I mentioned, is largely attributed to the scanning project. And then we had an increase in property, plant, and equipment that was largely attributed to the move from one location to the other for the office. And I'll pause here, Madam Chair, before I transition into the Alarm Systems Licensing Board.
Questions from the committee?
Thank you. Good presentation. Thank you for the work that you do. Don't want to put you on the spot here, but this year the House passed House Bill 566. I think it's 114-3. It's over in the Senate now, and it deals with some changes that not only the alarm board, but the Private Protective Services Board had requested. I think Representative Burr, Faircloth, and I were also primary sponsors on that bill. Could you elaborate a little bit, if you can, on that bill, how important that bill is to your board?
If I may, Madam Chair, and I should have mentioned this before, several board members are here from Private Protective Services, and the board's attorney is also here, and I hate to put any of you on the spot, but Mr. Gray, if I may yield to him or defer to him for questions regarding that legislation. I'm not sure if he has any information.
Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative McNeil. As the bill's been pending in the legislature, did stall in the Senate, but it has passed the House. I won't call it a systemic rewrite of the board's law. It is a moderning of the law. It's bringing it more up to date to current times. It makes slight changes in some of the scope of the board's law, with the most notable being it adds a new category of licensing for what is called executive protection, which is the new term. You're probably familiar with bodyguard services. Right now, private investigators are the only persons that can perform that service, and it's expanded to the point that the board feels that there needs to be more exhaustive training for persons that do engage in that. There is a slight fee increase in there. We have never charged a fee for the proprietary category of licensees, proprietary being those businesses that have their own in-house security. The unarmed guards for proprietary businesses do not have to be registered with this board. You can be a proprietary entity and have no dealings whatsoever with the state or the board. However, if you have unarmed guards, no dealings with the state. But if you have armed guards, the proprietary still has to come through North Carolina's Private Protective Services Board for registration of their guards only. This is going to we're going to start charging a small fee to be able to track those proprietary companies. If you do have a question from your constituents about the bill, this is because we have many companies that don't exist anymore that are still on our list. For instance, we still have Wachovia and Wells Fargo. We have a number of the hospitals that have now merged into a single entity, such as Novant. And so it's just a small fee as a way to get them to renew with us. The rest of the changes, as I say, are just modernizing some of the language. And most of them have been requested by the industry, such as some changes in our firearms law. We have Duke Energy Progress in North Carolina with their nuclear power plant. They are governed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and which has a different set of rules for their guards. Because of the fact that they still have to register in North Carolina their armed guards, we are hamstringing Duke Energy Progress with our requirements for firearms trainings. They far exceed the minimum for armed guards in North Carolina. So we are trying to give Duke Energy Progress some relief for their armed guards at their nuclear plant. So the vast majority of these changes are requested by the industry, and then, as I say, to try to bring us up to more modern times with events that have occurred in the industry and in the overall security business.
Any follow-up, Mr. Representative McNeil?
No follow-up. I just wanted to point out, since we were going over this, that there is some legislation pending that will help them modernize their board.
So I have a question, Mr. Gray, if you could answer, please. The board members, were they involved in the creation of the legislation that has passed the House?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, absolutely. It was prepared by the Law and Rules Committee, Ms. Larimore, Ms. Nada Larimore, who is an appointee of this body to the board, is the chair of our Law and Rules Committee, and it had involvement of all board members. What happened here is that through the years, the industry members have pointed out shortcomings. The board has tried to work around it. So the chair, Eric Weaver, appointed, or not appointed, we had the committee there. It was just called the Rules Committee. It's for administrative rules, but they changed the name of the committee when they set about writing a new statute, new language for the statute. So they reviewed our statute. They looked at the items that the industry had asked for through the years for changes. As I say, we had found workarounds for some of them. And with things like Duke Energy, we'd sort of kind of turned a blind eye because of the federal regulations. We felt like that the federal government's regulations had supremacy. We talked with Duke's counsel, legal counsel, et cetera, tried to work it out there. But it just came time that we needed a bill to make these changes official.
Thank you, and I do have a follow-up. So as this bill, House Bill 566, as it progressed, and looking at the history, it appeared that there were was changes to the bill. Was the board involved in those changes, or did those changes come from the Department of Public Safety?
To my knowledge, Madam Chair, all of them came from the board or the industry. As you know, when there is a bill out there, not to use a pun, but it gives everybody a target, and we're talking about firearms training especially, so when they have something on a piece of paper to shoot at, they sometimes shoot at it. So the board did accommodate suggestions to the bill, and yes, there were some slight amendments in committee on it. I cannot think of any that were not vetted through the board after the industry made the request for changes. I cannot think of any right off. To my knowledge, there were none from DPS. And as I say, I think all of the bill sponsors are actually in the room today.
Thank you. I think you have one missing. So the fee that you reference, is the fee included in House Bill 566?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, we as you know, we have to have a fee. We have to have statutory authority in a fee. And as we say, we kept it at the bare minimum, just enough to give us the money to process the application. But the main reason was for us to be able to require these proprietary companies to renew with us, so we don't have this long, exhaustive list of proprietary companies that actually do not exist anymore.
Do you have to have an MOU with the Department of Public Safety?
Yes, ma'am. We don't have to. It was requested after the move to the Department of Public Safety. Under the Department of Justice, there was no MOU that we could ever find. It kind of evolved. These two boards evolved under the Department of Justice. Interestingly enough, they started out under the SBI. And were staffed by an SBI agent. Mr. Jones, his predecessor, about five back, was actually an SBI agent. But it evolved. There was never an MOU. When it came under the, when you all placed them under the Department of Public Safety, at that time, Secretary Perry and his legal staff requested that there be an MOU. And there one has been drafted and is pending at this time. In answer to your question, do we have to? I mean, I can't say that there's nothing in the statute, as their legal counsel, I can't say that there's anything in the statute that requires it, but there has been one proposed.
So has it been presented to the board?
Yes, ma'am. It has been presented to the Private Protective Services Board and is pending, and the Alarm Systems Licensing Board has already signed the Memorandum of Understanding. And it sort of lays out the matters that were on Mr. Jones's first PowerPoint screen.
Thank you. Senator Wells.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jones, thanks for being here. Some of us on this committee are more used to dealing with independent licensing boards, and this one is a little different because it's housed in an agency, so you're kind of unusual. So some of us are used to dealing them with the 55 independents. So with those boards, the financials are pretty freestanding. and you can kind of understand what comes and goes. Would it be possible for you to provide to the committee some, you know, 2-3 years worth of financials so we can kind of see a little more detailed look at how money flows between the department and the licensing boards? And is there any overlap among the boards, among these two boards, or how does that, how do those dollars flow? And then when you get into outside contracts, how does that, I just like to look at the money.
I'd be happy to share more detailed information about the finances. DPS provides all the financial management or support. I do know that in fiscal year 17, to answer your question, the statutory fee was paid by Private Protective Services Board and Alarm Systems Licensing Board. So currently the fee structure divides the board's responsibilities for those services. So if there's a charge that's encumbered, generally we split 75-25. 75% is bear by or borne by Private Protective Services Board. The remaining 25% is by Alarm Systems Licensing Board.
Did that answer your question? So, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jones, are you familiar with the psychological stress examiners, or I think it's also called voice stress analysis, that some states outlaw that, don't allow them to be used based upon some questions of whether or not they are accurate. Can you give us any information about that?
So I can provide information, but as a disclaimer, the information that I'm privy to is as a result of my work as a criminal investigator in Florida, where, again, full disclaimer, in 2000-ish, I was licensed by the company to provide computer voice stress analysis, and our agency in Florida engaged in that work, and I've operated several of those tests. I am aware of some of the scrutiny that one company in particular I know of has come under in some of that work with regard to the methodology, but I do not know the impact in North Carolina or the extent to which that's had an impact in our state.
Follow up. Would it be appropriate for us to request that you get us some more information about that, perhaps why other states have viewed it that way? Because I know that's used by a lot of our agencies. We did a survey some time back, and particular law enforcement agencies use it, but they use it primarily for investigative purposes, and in some cases for hiring. It troubles me that if there is a lack of accuracy there, which I don't hear that kind of talk about polygraph, that's well accepted. But if there is a question there, I think we want to make sure we're on the right side of that issue. So if you could get us some information about that.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Representative Faircloth.
Other questions? One last question. You mentioned that you are transitioning to an electronic system within the department. Yes. Is the board and the industry being involved in the creation of the software that would run their operation?
Madam Chair, yes, the board and the industry have been involved. Two board members actually have been involved in the testing and the development of that software. Of course, this began a couple of years ago before I assumed the position as director. Since then, we've had industry involvement. There's been communication with the industry. We've provided newsletters back in October about instructions about how to use that. There have been training webinars to involve the industry in how to become acclimated to that. We're continuing to work with DPS IT to provide additional training in the coming months to make sure that the industry is familiar with that software. And the board has been involved. And all I can speak to, of course, is the time that I've been here, but I've tried to be very proactive about involving the board in everything related to the relationship that the agency has with Promedium.
Thank you.
So
you will proceed with the
alarm. So yes, Madam Chair.
I wanted to make sure that I got on the right page.
Okay.
So the alarm. Storms Licensing Board.
Yes, page 13 in your presentation. I'm sorry, 12. So similar to the PPSB or Private Protective Services Board, the Alarm Systems Licensing Board operates pursuant to 74D of the General Statutes. There are fewer board members. There are seven positions for the board. And again, this board administers licensing, registration, and training requirements for the alarm systems profession. They also meet, as I described, six times a year. They have two-day meetings. Same structure. They consider licensing applications and then formal complaints or grievances, and then act on those as a full board. The categories, of course, for alarm licensing is not as broad. The licensing represents alarm companies in North Carolina, whereas registrants largely represent the number of installers or technicians that actually install the alarm systems. So there's only really two primary or main categories for licensing and registration. We've had a slight decrease in the number of registrations from 2016 to 2017, and also license holders in this area. Similarly, the board hears grievances. Their high point in recent past was in 2013 when they heard 56 formal complaints, and last year heard 26. With regard to the finances, this board is a smaller portion of Private Protective Services, so their revenues and expenditures aren't as great. They've also seen an increase in expenditures and a decrease in revenues. Again, they're sharing some of these costs for the office move and for the document archiving project, so their increase in expenditures is largely represented by those two main factors in recent past. Their revenue sources are not as diverse as Private Protective Services, again, because you have basically one category of registrants and one category of licenses. So their license and registration fees represent a higher percentage, 91% of revenues than PPSB. They also have interest-bearing accounts that yield revenue and the same type of administrative fees for audit and investigative recovery, and also late fees for submission of applications. And again, there's been an increase in property, plant, and equipment because they're sharing some of those expenses of the move, and also with purchase services with regard to the document archive project has increased. And we've touched on this, but Permidium was a project that started, I believe, a couple years ago. Again, the agency has received paper applications for registrations and licenses. So there's a lot of paper moving hands between some of the research, the processing assistants and the investigators. The Permidium system will eliminate paper largely because the industry, whether it's a license or a licensee, will be able to submit all of the information online through Permidium's portal. So if a licensee can apply for licensure, the companies can also register employees. If they have unarmed guards, there used to be a paper application that they'd have to mail in with a check the agency would receive. Now all of that will be done online. They can register employees, they can maintain a roster of their employees, and they'll also be able to pay online. It's a fee for service, so there was no initial expense for the use of the software. Permidium has been developing this for Private Protective Services. There's a convenience fee that's charged for the submission of applications, and then a credit card transaction fee, similar to what you see in other services online. So that hopefully will ease the process, not only for the industry, but also for our employees who will handle less paperwork and hopefully just create a more efficient process. The first phase went live on November 1st, which was registration. And we're still, of course, with any new software project dealing with some hurdles along the way and challenges, but we're addressing those. The next phase that we're going to go live with, a date hasn't been determined, but that will be licensing, and we're still permitting to kind of put the final touches on that before we go live with that, and hope to announce that that's going to be implemented in the next couple months, and hopefully we'll ease the process for everyone. And I'd be happy to take any additional questions.
Questions for Mr. Jones? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Jones, for coming today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So added to our agenda today, we were requested to hear from State Search and Rescue. So that was added to our agenda, so we will yield the floor.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. I'm very cognizant of my position today on the agenda, and therefore I will use a very wise councilman that once told me the best meeting in the world is one that starts with a humorous opening, ends very quickly with a timely recap and closing. So I will try to stick to that advice today. My name is Buddy Martinette. I'm the fire chief in Wilmington, North Carolina. I'm here today as a sponsoring fire chief for one of the seven state rescue teams that are geographically located around the state of North Carolina. I'm accompanied by my cohort, Chief Donnie Hall from New Hanover County Fire Department, and I'm also here represented today by some of the Raleigh firefighters who have come up here to join us in this. But we're also representing almost 1,500 very highly specialized rescue personnel, and also representing the over 10 million North Carolinians that this program protects across this great state. I'm here today specifically to provide you an update on the status of the State Rescue Team program, its deployment methods, its history, and some of our challenges we have with maintaining our team's excellent capabilities. So I thought one of the best ways to do that is to talk about the evolution of the program itself, and we can do that with regards to three specific times, 1999, 2004, and 2016. So what I would tell you, in 1999, we had Hurricane Floyd, and we were deploying rescuers across the state in response to Hurricane Floyd. At that particular time, our rescuers had very limited training, if any, minimum organization, and no standardized equipment to effect these rescues. The rescuers were requested and deployed. However, there were no structured state search and rescue resources, and therefore an unknown number of rescues occurred during that time. If you move ahead to 2004, we've made a lot of progress with regards to our efforts. Hurricane Francis, Ivan, and Jean. At this point, we were beginning to build an organized capability. We had developed a regional concept for how we were providing our services. We had partnered with other resources, such as the National Guard Aviation Unit, to more adequately respond to our many counties' needs. These efforts alone in 2004 resulted in over 1,500 rescues of North Carolinians by the SAR program. Moving ahead to 2014, Hurricanes Matthews and Tropical Storm Julia. The program continued to improve, and in fact, in 2016, all aspects of our program were tested. For instance, two students missing on the Appalachian Trail in Haywood County were helicopter rescue and mountain resource mobilized to find the two students who were in critical condition from hypothermia. We also had swift water rescue and urban search and rescue resources utilized in Birdie County, rescuing 138 people, including working with regional health care resources to evacuate a flooded nursing home in Windsor. So we also had Hurricane Matthew. Very timely, and everybody remembers Hurricane Matthews. 50 counties in North Carolina declared federal disaster areas. All hands response from Swift Water Rescue and Search and Rescue resources responded to counties' needs. Additional federal search and rescue resources also mobilized during that event to support a unified search and rescue response. So what made the difference is really the key to this. Well, if we contrast 1999 to 2016, we can show the progress and impact of our program. The program was born out of a demonstrated need for Hurricane Floyd, and then funding through federal grants after the September 11th terror attacks. The program has evolved to respond to needs identified through county partners, through the Search and Rescue Technical Advisory Committee, as outlined in North Carolina General Statute 166A. So our federal grant impacts. The North Carolina State Rescue Program was funded mainly through federal preparedness grants. As North Carolina has been hit by disasters of all sizes, the program has evolved to meet the needs of both counties and urban and rural areas. North Carolina's program has become a national model in building local capability through a coordinated statewide program, as it is both cost-effective and more comprehensive in focus than most programs in other states. In fact, we routinely get requests here in North Carolina for information to help other states try and build similar programs. So now the bad news. Since 2012, federal preparedness grants have drastically declined. This has pushed sustainment costs almost completely on local governments, as North Carolina's emergency management's only funding mechanism has been through these federal grants. One of our challenges is the current grant amounts cannot adequately sustain the program. As a matter of fact, the effect of the reduced grant amount started the initiative to have the program recognized in North Carolina general statutes and the further efforts to seek sustainment funds, which started a couple of years ago. So here's a snapshot of recent impacts. In addition to hurricane and flood responses, the program also supports other non-traditional missions, such as the fires we had in western North Carolina. The state SAR program has significant logistical resources to support extended search and rescue operations. The same resources are critical in other disasters and were critical in the 2016 wildfire responses in western North Carolina. In this instance, the state SAR program provided and supported the base of operations for over 500 firefighters from across the state. Resources provided including housing for first responders, all-terrain forklifts to move supplies, communication support, as well as rapid response resources to rescue any injured firefighters in remote or high-risk areas. Just so you can appreciate the full effect of this state rescue program, I would provide the following. In Moore County, Hurricane Matthew, we deployed swift water and helicopter resources to aid with the evacuation as well as aerial assessments of the Wood Lake Dam. In Buckham, Jackson, Haywood, Swain, Burke, and Rutherford counties, we deployed helicopter rescue assets for rapid extrication of firefighters fighting the 2016 wildfire outbreak in western North Carolina. Additionally, at the Party Rock Fire, we deployed rescue assets resources to establish a base camp for hundreds of responders and provided communications, both phone and internet, for the command post use. Cumberland, Robeson, Columbus, Craven, Hurricane Matthew, we deployed swift water, helicopter, and search and rescue resources to aid in evacuations, search flooded areas, and conduct a majority of the 2,336 documented rescues that occurred during that event. Onslow County, wilderness search and rescue resources were deployed to aid in the Myra Woods search. supported the Onslow County Sheriff's Office, FBI, and NCIS in searching for what turned out to be a false abduction case. Burke, Haywood, and Jackson County, numerous wilderness, mountain, and helicopter rescues. These areas made up a majority of the lost or injured hikers, and state resources were deployed to assist. Burke, Haywood, Jackson, Swain, Hurricane Francis, Ivan, and Jean in western North Carolina caused catastrophic flooding and landslides. Swift water, urban search and rescue resources deployed throughout western North Carolina to support these counties. Wake, Bertie, Lee, Harnett, and Wilson. A tornado outbreak on April 16th. Urban search and rescue resources were deployed to conduct a wide area search and communication supports for the counties and the rescue personnel that responded to these tornadoes. The success of this program is the local and state partnership. State and local resources coming together from across the state to solve complex rescue issues have paid dividends in North Carolina. In addition to preparing for search and rescue needs, the program builds relationships across our state to make the entire response community stronger in North Carolina. This SAR program that we're talking about covers five mission areas and incorporates resources from across North Carolina, from the smallest communities of the state to the largest. As you can see, each one of these items on this map, helicopter rescue, swift water or flood resource rescue assets, urban search and rescue assets, mountain rescue or missing persons and wilderness search, these are all used to save lives. Each symbol on the map represents a team within the state SAR program. Together, they represent the state's first line of response to support county needs, from the single search dog that can help find a lost child to a large 80-person search and rescue task force that can be quickly mobilized to work wide area search after a flood, hurricane, tornado, or landslide, or a collapsed reinforced concrete building. What makes the program strong is its diversity, both in its skills and also its geography. During large events, unaffected areas of the state can surge to support affected areas. These resources come from both rural and urban areas. From a single city to several counties working together to form a regional response capability, we're ready to support the citizens and visitors of our state. The program itself costs about $4.8 million to support annually. We have, the last several years, been requesting funds to fund the training of first responders, the maintenance of equipment, and the annual exercises to test our capabilities of the program. This request has been in the form of about $2.5 million. The balance of that and the 4.8 is in with respect to the fact that local governments also participate in this program and benefit by the location of these teams. Again, the goal of this program is local and state governments working together to address statewide need for specialized search and rescue operations. In 2014 session, the search and rescue program was established in North Carolina General Statutes 166A as a program of the state emergency response system. The session law required a study of cost to be completed and then submitted to fiscal research. This report was completed and it formed the basis of the initial funding request. To date, the program has not been successful in securing recurring funding. Last session, House Bill 189 and Senate Bill 222 was introduced with the full support of local and state partners, but we were unsuccessful in this language being incorporated into the final budget. So the key takeaways for today's presentation. One, We have a great partnership with the state that includes our local resources that is rescuing people across this state almost on a daily basis. We are prepared as a state, much more than many other states, to provide even for the most complex of rescue situations, be them man-made, through terrorist incidents, or through natural events. It's a great partnership between local and state governments. We would like to keep that program going. We would like to keep the safety of these first responders the foremost on our minds as chief officers and sponsoring fire chiefs in this thing. But our capabilities are limited, and sustainment for this program is going to be required if we're going to maintain the excellent service that we provide. The program has saved many lives in North Carolina. And with that, I would close, Madam Chair, and answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee. I have one question. I know this past year in discussions we talked about possibly seeking funding through the Hurricane Matthew Relief Fund or the Disaster Relief Fund. Were you able to receive any funding through the Hurricane Matthew Relief Fund?
Ma'am, I have Brian Barnes from the Department of Emergency Management that is here. He's our Emergency Services Branch Coordinator, and I think he'd be able to answer that question.
Madam Chair, I'm Brian Barnes, North Carolina Emergency Management, Emergency Services Branch Manager. And to answer your question, no, ma'am, we were not successful in securing that funding.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Chief, for coming today.
Yes, ma'am, thank you.
So this ends our agenda. Are there any other issues that any members want to bring before the committee or comments? Seeing none, I wish you all a very Merry Christmas, and I will see you in the new year. Thank you.